Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Very few things in science are as rock solid as Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Enshrined in that theory is the notion of a constant speed of light. It's the C in E equals mc squared, and almost all of physics is based on it. But what if Einstein was wrong? This theory has been called into question by João Maguejo, a professor of theoretical physics at Imperial College in London, England. In his recent book, Faster Than the Speed of Light, The Story of a Scientific Speculation, Maguejo asserts that the speed of light is not constant and uses that argument to explain the origin of black holes in the universe, which cannot be explained if the speed of light is accepted to be 186,000 miles per second. I spoke recently with Professor João Maguejo when he was in San Francisco, California. As a backdrop or an understanding to his theory that light has a variable speed, I asked him to begin by explaining Einstein's theory of relativity.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difficult bit, varying speed of light theories and all these new ideas. They're really not that difficult. The difficult bit is Einstein's theory itself. In a nutshell, it's a theory of space and time and the universe, which is based upon the idea that the speed of light is a constant. It doesn't matter how you move, where you are, what color of light you have, you always see the same speed of light. And it is really counterintuitive. It's you know, if you move on a highway, you'll see that the way you move changes the way the other cars with respect to you are moving. That's why you brake, that's why you accelerate. Light is the kind of car going down this highway. It doesn't matter if you brake, if you accelerate, if you go the opposite direction. You always see light moving at the same speed. This is called the constancy of the speed of light postulate of the theory of relativity. And it is crazy because if the speed of light is the same for everyone, what it means is that space and time cannot be the same for everyone. They're relative. And what comes out of it is just this conception of time as something flexible, time that something that can dilate or contract depending on your state of motion.
Can you explain what you mean that space and time are not the same for everyone?
Yeah, so the classical idea is the so-called twin paradox, which is not a paradox, but it's the idea of two twins. One goes on a trip at very high speeds around the universe. When they come back, they find they have different ages. The one who has gone around the universe has stayed much younger than the other one. So the way time flows depends on your state of motion. It's not the same for everyone. And likewise, space is not the same for everyone. You take a meter stick or a rod or something, and it will appear contracted if you're moving with respect to it. And these are the crazy implications of the theory of relativity and of giving the absolute stamp to something which is not space or time, but the speed of light instead.
Well, it's very theoretical when you use your twin example of one traveling around the universe and one not, and the traveler coming back younger. How do you explain that theory to those of us who are here on Earth?
Well, it's no longer theoretical. These things have been measured.
How do you measure it?
You don't actually measure them with twins. This is just, of course, a metaphor. But, you know, if you take one of these high-precision clocks, you send it on a plane around the Earth several times, you do see the effect. You know, you really need a high-precision clock because the plane is not moving at a very high speed with respect to the speed of light. So the effect is very small. But the effect is there, and it has been measured. And there's many, many other observations and experiments which reveal that this is the way nature works. And you will never see these at its most extreme because you'd have to be moving really, really fast, much, much faster than anything can move with present technology. But we certainly can measure these effects.
So where do we go with this? What do we do with this information?
We do a lot of technology. Every time you go to the hospital, all the technology around you uses the theory of relativity. It's not as if it's a question of is this theory right or wrong? It's been converted into technology already. So it's a very solid piece of theoretical physics. It's not just theoretical physics. It is actually some piece of theoretical physics that has been exported into engineering, some types of engineering at least.
For example?
Well, as I said, only electronics things you use, your cell phone, other kinds of things. You know, they really use, bits of information which you would not understand if you were not to use the theory of relativity. So it's not lightly. You cannot do this lightly. Abandoning the theory of relativity is not something you can do very lightly. There's a huge body of data you have to consider before you do something like that. And if the things I told you sound really beyond the realm of everyday experience, they are beyond the realm of everyday experience, but not at the level of when you look at how things work, the things you use all the time, your TV set, everything, all that stuff has ingrained in it the theory of relativity.
Yet you are challenging Einstein's theory of relativity, saying that the speed of light is not a constant, that it in fact varies under certain circumstances.
So I needed a very good reason to do that. And the good reasons were not, you know, anything which has been measured on Earth. As I said, things really work very well on Earth. Another example is probably nuclear weapons. That's probably the case in which the theory of relativity has led to something quite dramatic in our history and the way we live on Earth. And the theory of relativity does work well for everything on Earth. It's cosmology. I am a cosmologist. I'm one of these guys who looks out at the universe and tries to come up with a model of the universe as a whole. What is the life of the universe? Was it born at a given moment? Is it going to die? Is it evolving? What is really the history of the universe? That's cosmology. And cosmology really, for many years, has been pointing towards a bigger theory, something which might be more complex than the theory of relativity, a richer structure. The theory we believe is correct at the moment is called the Big Bang Theory of the universe. The universe is expanding. That's an observational fact. This means it was very concentrated many years ago. And in fact, the conclusion is that the universe started with a Big Bang some 15 billion years ago. And the Big Bang Theory is very successful, but there's so many holes in it when you start looking carefully. We certainly know that at the moment of the Big Bang, the physics must have been different from the physics we measure here on Earth, because the temperature was very, very much higher. It was totally very extreme conditions, very high energies, and it's very unlikely that the physics here and now was the same physics back then.
So how does that apply to us, again, on an everyday level?
It doesn't really. I mean, it does if you're interested in knowing where you came from. You came from this baby universe, which was really very hot. It was like a nuclear explosion. The Big Bang was really a very high-energy explosion. The beginning of the universe is really, it's basically the cradle from which you come from is nothing like this low-temperature climate in which life can come up and we can live. And the problem is that, really, the big problem with the Big Bang Theory of the universe is that it does not really explain why the universe is the same everywhere. There is this problem, there is this unity in the universe, this nearly pantheistic unity. Everything is the same everywhere, the galaxies look the same everywhere, the universe is expanding the same way everywhere, temperature is the same. And what you find when you look at the Big Bang, at the moment of the Bang, is the universe totally fragmented into regions that do not know about each other. They're totally disconnected. And the reason is simply that light is also a speed limit. Speed of light, you cannot travel faster than light. And as the universe becomes younger and younger, this means you cannot have moved very far. No interaction, nothing can have moved very far since the beginning of the universe. And this kind of splits the universe into many different regions, which mysteriously all come up the same way later on. And this is one of the problems which cosmologists have to face. It's called the horizon problem, because these regions are called horizons. And this was the thing I was trying to solve when I proposed the varying speed of light theory. I just realized that if light was much faster at the beginning of the universe, if the speed limit was raised right at the bang, the moment of the Big Bang, then we could solve all these problems. We could actually bring the whole universe into contact and explain the universe the way it is.
So what I hear you saying, Zhao, is that the Big Bang theory of the universe has some unexplainable aspects which are explained if you say light has a variable speed.
Yes.
So what are those unexplained aspects, and how does the variable speed of light explain them?
Well, there's many problems, but the one I mentioned is exactly that these concordance of properties all over the universe.
What does that mean, concordance of properties?
It just means things look the same everywhere. You look out in the sky.
All right.
And when you do that, if you look very far away, you can take a picture of the past. Well, things you look up in the sky are really history, because if you look at something which is, say, a billion light years away from you, that means light took a billion years to get from there to you. So you're really seeing these things a billion years ago. So you're taking this picture of the past, and when astronomers do that, they find this universe in the past, and they can actually look at these vast regions at the very beginning, and they really all look the same, and by which I mean they are. You can see the way they're expanding. They're expanding the same way. You can see the way the baby galaxies being formed. They look exactly the same. You can see the temperature. There's this kind of cosmic radiation involving everything. You can measure this temperature. It looks exactly the same everywhere. And you would expect that, how do things become the same? For instance, you can bring a hot body and a cold body together, and they get the same temperature after a while. There's thermal flows between the hot and the cold bodies until they become the same. So you might expect the universe became the same via a similar process. Maybe everything came together earlier on, and these homogenizing processes, like thermal currents, made sure everything became eventually the same. And the horizon problem tells you can't do that, because any thermal current, anything, must have traveled slower than light, and light itself doesn't have enough time to travel very far since the beginning of the universe.
By thermal current, you mean the movement of heat?
It could be heat, yes, exactly.
Or something else?
It could be other things. The heat is the simplest mechanism we considered. And you really need these currents to be faster if you're going to really make them efficient. The universe is very big. You know, the things you can see out in the sky is really a very vast region. And these vast regions are completely fragmented into billions of regions that don't know about each other in the conventional theory. Unless you open up the horizons, and the way to open up the horizons for the Big Bang is exactly to make things travel faster at the beginning.
I'd like you to explain what you mean to make things travel faster, or interpret things as having traveled faster. But first I'd like to say that this week we're talking with Zhao Magwejo, a theoretical physicist, talking about his recent book called Faster Than the Speed of Light, The Story of a Scientific Speculation. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Zhao, when you say faster than the speed of light, or a variable speed of light, does the variance of the speed of light go slower than 186,000 miles per second, or 300,000 kilometers per second, or does it only go faster?
It could go either way. So once we had this theory, we came up with a theory, this property in which the speed of light could vary. Once you have the equations, you can solve them in all kinds of situations. So you can plug them in for an expanding universe and see what comes out. What comes out, of course, is a time evolution in the speed of light. Or you can plug in something like what happens around the sun, and you find there are spatial variations. As you approach the sun, the speed of light varies. Very, very little with the sun, but you could consider something extreme like a black hole, a very massive object. And there you find the opposite. Whereas in the expanding universe, the speed of light slows down with evolution, and the early universe has much faster light. If you approach a black hole, exactly the opposite happens. You tend to get slower light. And so it can work either way. It depends on the circumstances.
What do you mean a black hole slows down the speed of light?
That's a very surprising effect. And it's something which, as I said, just pops out of the theory. We don't really understand why, to be very honest. But it's what comes out of the theory. So it's a prediction of the theory. Normally, in relativity, a black hole is something which, as a region beyond which you just cannot return. There's a so-called horizon for the black hole. If you cross the horizon, that's it. You have to fall into the black hole. You cannot come out of it again. In this theory, the speed of light actually becomes zero on its surface. And the speed of light is still a speed limit in these theories. In relativity, you can't travel faster than light. Here, you can travel faster than light locally. But there's different speeds of light at different places and different times. Now, the speed of light going to zero means your speed limit has become zero. So this is the ultimate traffic light. You cannot cross it. This is your red traffic light around the black hole. So what it means physically is that essentially you've protected this region inside the horizon from anyone coming into it. You've basically removed it from the realm of regions which are accessible by observers because you cannot penetrate something which is surrounded by a zero speed limit.
Does that mean that it's not there?
It means it's not accessible. So I would say it's not there. I mean, physics is about things that are physically accessible. So if something is not physically accessible, you say it's been removed from the universe.
So if we go back in the history of our species, maybe 1,000 years, where some people have not traveled to North America because it's beyond the curve of the Earth, which may have been thought to have been flat, or beyond what might have been called the frontier, that would also come up with the statement that it's not there.
Well, but it was there in principle. You could have gone there. It's different when you have a law of physics stating that you just cannot get there, full stop.
Zhao, how did you arrive at the theory of the variable speed of light?
It's strange because you need to be somehow outside physics to propose something this crazy. There is this just reaction, this ingrained reaction in every physicist. The speed of light cannot change. So, as I said before, there were all these problems lying around. I was a young cosmologist. I wanted to solve these problems. I didn't know how to solve them. It's very obvious that the faster light in the early universe solves them, but somehow there's a mental block there. Physicists cannot admit to that just because of the way we brought up. We brought up with this firm belief that Einstein is right. Nowadays, that's even the grammar of physics. It's the foundations of everything. So, well, it's a fact. It's my book. I was terribly hungover one morning. It was after a big party. My mind could not have been further away from physics when I finally understood that, you know, this was exactly what we were looking for. Something this crazy was the solution to all these problems. And I realized it was very simple. It was a very minimalistic way to address all these problems all in one go. And these insights, unfortunately, don't count for anything unless you spend years and years trying to make them into a theory. So what followed was really years and years of hard work trying to convert this beautiful insight I had this morning, that morning, into a beautiful theory.
When you were able to articulate this theory, what was the reaction of your colleagues?
Well, unsurprisingly, people were not impressed. It really is very heretical to say something like that, and people's reaction ranged from hysterical laughter to just avoiding discussing the problem. And it's weird because we're always arguing with each other. The way theoretical physics works is scientists just discussing permanently, throwing new ideas at each other. That is the kind of environment you live in. And when you throw ideas at each other, you don't expect to have finished ideas. Sometimes you don't even expect the other person to make sense, as long as you're just trying out new things. So it was very surprising that this idea, a varying speed of light, caused such a negative reaction from the start. This was not even just a crazy idea, it was beyond that. It was off scale. And it was at this point that I realized maybe I was onto something very important.
When was this that you came up with your theory of the variable speed of light?
This was several years ago. It was like 95 or 96. And the theory didn't actually become a theory for another 2-3 years after that.
So it's really been a theory for maybe 5 years, 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the reception of your colleagues in the past years since you've explained it? Are they still treating you as a heretic?
No, it's changing. One of the big things that happened since was that some astronomers found evidence for what could be a varying speed of light theory. You can actually, using this trick I mentioned earlier on, looking far away, you look into the past, you can actually try and measure the speed of light in the past. And that's what these guys have been doing. And there is some evidence for what really would be a prediction of this theory. So this put things on a different plane. And I really must thank the astronomers for doing that more than the theorists. It's true that after our first paper was published, there was a gradual interest by other theorists. But I think it was the astronomers that really made us a bit more respectable. Physics is about observations. It's not just about theories. And if you have observations supporting your theory, then people take you more seriously.
Well, now in the winter of 2003, you're traveling around the United States promoting your book, Faster Than the Speed of Light. Beyond selling your book, which is a very interesting read, what are you seeking to do with disseminating this knowledge and these theories?
I should distinguish between my scientific work and writing this book. My scientific work, which is really where the varying speed of light theory is continuing, and the community working there is just expanding. But by writing this book, what I wanted to do was popularize relativity, first of all, because you have to explain relativity before you explain why you're trying to bypass it. But I also wanted to talk about the process of coming up with a new idea, and this is why my book is the biography or the story of a scientific speculation. I really would like to explain to people how we come up with new ideas. It's not a very rational process. We really behave very irrationally at the beginning. Scientists really, you know, they move from hunches, they have their own tastes, their own egos, and I think it's a fascinating human process which is very rewarding, but it's very well hidden from the public most of the time. We really only like to present the final product. Very few people have actually gone into what happens without trying to draw comparisons, actually. But James Watson, Double Helix, in which he describes how the DNA was discovered, is one of the few examples where people really go into the ins and outs of making a discovery. Except James Watson only wrote it after he knew he was right. I think it's better to write this while it's still happening and you don't know yet if it's right or wrong. It's you know, things will not be sanitized at all at this stage. And that's the kind of picture I wanted to draw with my book. I wanted to go into that process.
Can you tell us more about the scientific process and scientific discovery that you're describing?
Yeah, it's about making lots of mistakes. You need to have collaborators. No one actually comes up with new theories on their own anymore. And I could not have come up with the varying speed of light theory without the right collaborator. It was Andy Albrecht, now at UC Davis. And so we work together, and it's whenever you work together, it's kind of a love-hate relationship, and it's complicated, and sometimes you really want to abandon ship, other times you're very enthusiastic. There's this kind of swing between things working very well and things being very depressing, and this is what science is about. And then there is the process of trying to get your work published once you finish it, and that is a battle. If you come up with something like this, as new as this, you basically up for a big uphill battle trying to get your work in press because your colleagues don't even think it's worth publishing. And then it's the whole process, what happens after. When, you know, you think you've done, you know, it's a question for observers to tell you if you're right or wrong. And there's kind of a 1-2 year process in which some people jump into it, other people hate it, some people think you're right, some people you think you're wrong, and you just keep arguing and arguing about it for a long time. A very surprising thing was when we finally got this published, we found that someone many years before in 1992 had come up with a similar idea. This was John Moffat at the University of Toronto. And he never managed to get it published in the journal where we got ours published, Physical Review. So we did know about his work. And this is just incredible. This is just very revealing that the idea is there. And more than one person will come up with the idea because it's an obvious thing. Maybe it's part of nature, it's not part of human constructions. At the same time, I think it also sheds light on the scientific process of trying to get things published. It is very random. We were very lucky. We actually were treated very fairly in the end. And I think John Moffat was not treated fairly. And it's just, you know, it's a lottery.
Who does the treating, fairly or unfairly?
Well, the way this works is your paper gets sent to referees, people we will read your work, supposedly, and then write a report on it. And very seldom these things are that objective. That's the problem. Most of the time people let the personal knowledge of the author get in the way. And it is when I say it's a lottery, I mean it. It's really a matter. Sometimes you treat it fairly because you get the right referee. Other times you just get someone who's not that honest, and you know it's a risk you're running.
What other projects are you working on now?
Oh, I'm doing many other things. I don't work on only varying speed of light theories. That would be crazy. I like to kind of combine mainstream physics with crazy physics. I count varying speed of light theories as crazy physics because it's so, you know, it's really pushing the frontier of science. And whenever you do that, it's very risky. I also do other things. I mean, I'm working on cosmic radiation, you know, supermassive black holes in the middle of galaxies. I'm working on various other things which are regarded as more acceptable by the community.
Well, Jean Maguejo, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I don't read physics very often. I mean, I do it as part of my work. And the last book I read, which I loved, was Angela's Ashes. And I highly recommend it to everyone. It's a biography. If you haven't seen it, it's a biography. Not a biography of a childhood, which I think is just beautiful.
Jean Maguejo, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
You're welcome.
Jean Maguejo is the author of Faster Than the Speed of Light, The Story of a Scientific Speculation, published by the Perseus Publishing Company. The book that he recommends is Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, ideas, and suggestions for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.